Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to another episode of the Daily Crane Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and today I'm joined by Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you doing?
I'm good, and yourself, Nick?
I'm doing pretty good, pretty good. And I'm not sure which of your mics it's coming through, but I hear the wonderful sound of chirping birds in the background, which is very peaceful. And of course, we are also joined by Mr. Herman Pretorius, who was looking at Impala or something last week. Welcome back, Herman. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. I just realized that I haven't, I mean, if you look at my visage in this camera thingy, I do look slightly like the villain in No Country for Old Men. I really should get a haircut.
Yes. Although I don't think you're quite as menacing. Anyway, let us leave the frivolity behind and go on to more serious things. So we didn't talk about it yesterday because, of course, the news is dominated by the Afghan crisis that's going on currently. But yesterday was 9 years since the Marikana massacre. So just a refresher, that was during a very violent strike at a platinum mine near Marikana. I think 12 people had been killed into the lead-up of it, workers who had refused to partake in the strike, as well as security guards. The police shot dead 34 miners, and there have been accusations that this was done quite deliberately, and there's been others who said that it was accidental and a result of bad police organization. But it in many cases, it was used as one of the founding pillars to kind of launch the EFF. And actually, they win that some of the wards around there, which is unusual for the EFF, who usually can't win wards anywhere in the country. So one of the latest developments is that Advocate Dalian Pofu is, of course, an EFF member who is representing the families of miners and miners who were injured or arrested in the Marikana, in the events around Marikana, has said that he and his clients are taking President Cyril Ramaphosa and Sibanye-Stillwater, the company, to court to demand that they honor their commitments to those who were affected by the Marikana massacre. And Pofu said, in the form of apologies, in the form of undertakings, this will not happen again. In the form of building a monument, not that nonsense that is done there by Sibanye of putting people's names without consulting the families. So, come on. What do you make of Marikana's impact since then, these latest developments? Do you still think have real impact on South Africa's political discourse?
Well, I think it was certainly a defining moment in South Africa's political discourse. It would be a bit of a stretch to equate it to something like Sharpeville, but I definitely think that there's a political conversation before and a political conversation after, and the incident at Marikana definitely closed a previous era when perceptions about big business, workers, unions, the ability of police to respond to these sorts of things. I definitely think that incident changed. It's a bit like the 9/11 thing on a global scale. There's a before and an after because the consequences of it might be severe, but it is everywhere. As you say, the EFF came from that, and it's still something hanging over President Ramaphosa of almost a decade later. But what really strikes me about the incident is how it gave rise to a lot of discussions, except discussions that approach a solution. Here was a problem of struggling sector made even more aggressive and more, sensitive to disturbances, the mining sector, by government policy. So then it made corporate hawks and corporate, exploiters even more desperate to exploit, because that's what happened when you sort of intervene in the ability of people to make money and you make it you know, you restrict that space. You think you're punishing them, but you're just inciting, you know, some of the most devious competitive exploitative behavior in corporates when you try to tame some rather dodgy corporate interests. So I think the first thing was that the economic policy and the sectoral policy and industrial policy of the mining chart and the consequences of that led to the arena in which Marikana happened. Not, of course, a causal link, but it fed into the pressure that the mining sector was experiencing. Secondly, labor laws, the fact that a labor dispute like this had to escalate to something so violent and so dangerous, where something like a secret strike ballot would have enabled those workers who did not want to strike to have their rights protected. Just the labor relations aspect wasn't addressed. And then, of course, you've got the police in terms of their training, their equipment, their readiness to cope with these sort of instances. And finally, you've got the component of BEE, with President Ramaphosa perhaps being the poster child for that. All of these things concocted something very, very terrible and tragic at Marikana. And the fact that not on one of those four elements, contributing factors, we've seen a real conversation about solutions shows that while there is a before Marikana and an after Marikana in terms of our political rhetoric, it is tragic that we haven't really looked at a before Marikana and after Marikana in terms of actual policies to solve the problems and to protect the most socioeconomically vulnerable people and to make it possible for them to find jobs that actually lead to upward social mobility and not just to cling to the jobs they have, even though there's no hope for real improvement. So in one sense, yes, it's been very significant. In another, it's been tragically one-dimensional.
So Terence, I want to get your thoughts on what Herman just said, but also I think we should talk a little bit, of course, about the trade union that was at the center of the strike around Marikana, and that is AMCU, Allied Metal Workers and Construction Union, I think it stands for. And they've had a rough couple of years. They, a couple of years ago, engaged in a very big strike, I think against some gold mines, also owned by Sibanye, and those failed because Neil Froneman kind of pushed them to the limit and they and broke them for the most part. But generally speaking, I think it's worth noting that the biggest example of police violence against violent strikers was when it was conducted by a union that wasn't aligned with the ANC. Am I drawing dots there that don't deserve to be drawn, or what do you make of that, Terence?
Well, look, I think that I agree 100% with what Herman said. I think that there was another dimension, though, that South Africa had kind of leered into this into a somewhat collusive relationship. There's quite a lot of evidence that you had a situation in the Marikana area where the National Union of Mine Workers was seen as being too pro-management. Their shop stewards, it's in a sense been co-opted, and AMCU stepped into that gap, picked up on some pre-existing traditions of militancy, and unfortunately, strike action in South Africa since the mid to late 80s has not always been a peaceful thing. Now, just to continue what Herman was saying, the Marikana shootings were the largest loss of life at the hands of the state since, I think, 1961. Interestingly, around that time, I had a gig where every couple of weeks a group of American college alumni would come to South Africa and they would go and sort of have a learning holiday, and I did one of the talks, and I always used to ask them who here was involved with the anti-apartheid movement, and there's always a couple, and I said, okay, Marikana as a single instance of state violence had a death toll that exceeded anything in the 1970s and 1980s. You know, obviously, if you want to take the Soweto uprising as a whole, you get a higher body count. But it's like one sort of flash. And I said, this demonstrates that there's something deeply, deeply wrong. But then again, you know, one could roll back a few years. Remember the security guard strike? I think there were about 69 people killed. Not a single prosecution, as far as I recall. There hasn't been any prosecutions coming out of Marikana. There's a dreadful sense of sort of foreboding and deja vu when one thinks about this. Like, you know, we've been here before because we have. And what does it mean? Very little is done, you know, merely to hold people accountable. Marikana was an example, but it's far from the only one.
Yeah, so I think for me, the thing that was really important about Marikana was that it was the sort of the perfect example of the consequences of the toxic labor relations in South Africa, and all these other things that go together with it, like the lack of accountability that Terence just talked about, and the sort of general dysfunction of economic policy. Herman, anything final to add before we move on to the next topic?
Yeah, I think what we see in all of the deadly, violent instances where labor relations, whether it's 1922, whether it's Marikana, it does strike one that whenever a government with guns serves a vested interest group, whether that's racial or economical or ethnic or cultural, whenever people with guns are on the receiving end of instructions given by a government more interested in protecting a specific group than actually in the protection of freedom and rights, property, the ability to work, the ability to earn an income, you always, and you should never be surprised when you see that escalate to a point of violence, because always, and this might be a well-worn trope among the American right, but there's some truth in it, that the authority of the state is at the end of the day ultimately enforced at the end of the barrel of a gun. And if people who are not accountable, who are not honest, are the people at the, you know, at the trigger point of that gun, you see violence, you see unnecessary bloodshed and the loss of life. I just think it's very clear that what's happening in South Africa is a smaller and smaller group of voters are giving a mandate to a government, aware of the fact that that group of voters is what gives them power. And the only way I think we can shift this is to reverse the idea of politics being the province of politicians and really try to get some civilian democracy, skin in the game back, that set, you know, fixing these sorts of things aren't someone else's problem in a state building somewhere. It really starts with us. I'm not saying we're responsible for Marikana, but I think we're responsible for where we go from here.
Right. All right, let us move on to our next story, and that is that the Democratic Alliance has, through asking questions in the Gauteng legislature, found out that there were about 23,000 teen pregnancies in the province of Gauteng between April 2020 and March 2021, so basically over the course of a year. This was the answer given by the MEC for Health in a reply to a question by the DA, by their shadow MEC for Social Development, Rufiwe Ntseke. According to the government, 934 babies were delivered by girls between the ages of 10 and 14, while over 19,000 were delivered by those between the ages of 15 and 19 years old. Nearly 3,000 girls between the ages of 10 and 19 aborted their children, their babies. And the DA called on the Gauteng Department of Social Development, Education and Health to intensify their campaign to prevent teenage pregnancy. So Rufiwe said, to teach girls in society at large the importance of not falling pregnant when they're still young, because when a girl falls pregnant, they're the ones who end up looking after the babies, and sometimes when there's no proper support system, there's no one assisting them. So obviously, I think everyone kind of agrees, you know, this is a problem all around the world. Teen pregnancy, it's really bad because, especially for girls, as Rafael always says, it's you get stuck often with a child. The children who grow up often are, shall we say, vulnerable to engaging in bad social behaviors. I think the vast majority of people in prisons around the world actually tend to grow up in households without two parents. But what can government actually do, Terrence, to stop something like this from happening, or at least to reduce its impact on society?
Well, I think this is the tragedy here is I'm not sure there's very much that government can do. This is a sociological problem, or a sociological phenomenon. I remember the late Agri Klaster, who's the editor of the Sowetans, in the 1980s, they ran this, what they call the nation building campaign, and been criticized as not amounting to very much. But I do remember listening to him talk about this, and he said, you know, what are the problems confronting South Africans? And one of them is the collapse of our social structure. And he said, the great tragedy of this is that South Africa has a decimated family structure, and we used to have strong families of both the European type, the African type, and the Asian type, you know, various permutations of extensions and nuclear families. And having traveled a great deal of Africa over the years, something that does strike me is that while you have severe socioeconomic stresses, while you have the poverty and the unemployment and whatever, it's very rare to find a place in Africa, except where there's some sort of active armed conflict, where the sense of sort of threat and danger is quite as it is. And I think a lot of this is because you have the state dysfunctionality, but you have a sort of social cohesion. I remember a guy from Nigeria who lives in South Africa telling me that when he takes his daughter back to his village, she can like disappear at 9 in the morning, and he knows she'll be back at 5 in the evening. He says he won't do that in Joburg. What can a state do? I don't know. You can offer palliatives, the child support and that sort of thing, which I personally think is right and good and very important. But changing the actual behavior, that's something for which government is simply not a good agent. Social pressure from things like church groups, you may be onto something better there. But remember, this is a pathology that's now several generations old in South Africa. And I don't have any easy answers. I think it's fair to point out, and I think very accurate to point out, that this is probably the area in which the injustices and inequities of our past show themselves in the most gaudy detail. Things like migrant labor, things like influx control that split the African family up. But as in many things, it is much easier to break something than to repair it. And for reparation, I have really no ideas.
No, it is definitely something that's very difficult to fix. And I mean, that's true all over the world. Even in societies that are much wealthier than ours, teen pregnancy continues to, in some cases, be quite a big problem. I just wonder, so Herman, I want your thoughts on this issue as well, but I also wanted to just mention something, Herman, that you noticed in the story that we got this from, which was written by Eyewitness News. There's a sort of strange little comment at the end of the news article, which is ostensibly just a reporting article that says, while the politicians have focused on girls, they haven't said anything about the men and boys who are impregnating them. So firstly, I think it's kind of funny because it's very obvious that the reporter was rather annoyed that this hadn't been mentioned. And so just slipped it into the story, which is not very professional of a journalist. But secondly, as to that point, what role, I mean, is there a point there? Should there also be a big focus on teaching men and boys, or what's your response to that?
The sad thing is I actually agree with that snarky little comment at the end of the piece. The problem is it's just packaged as journalism when it isn't. I think that's a point worth making. I think it reflects badly on the attitude of these media houses and many journalists towards parties like the DA, because this was the DA that raised this question. The whole report is if the only politicians really mentioned as politicians and not as government officials are DA people. So the politicians, it is criticism of the DA, which I think is a merited point to make, that, you know, addressing the balance of both genders involved in creating a child. But I do think it's snarky and unnecessary to, you know, pretend that's sort of some form of a journalistic insight. If you want to make that point as a journalist, write a proper thing, write a piece, put your name to it, make that point. If you believe in it enough, surely you should have the courage of your conviction to do at least that. While Terence was talking, two things struck me. Firstly, the first chapter of Cry the Beloved Country is, I love that book. I genuinely love that book. But there's this beautiful juxtaposition of describing the Ikopo Valley, I think is how you pronounce it, and, you know, the grass is thick and you cannot see the soil. And Peyton beautifully, ironically, Peyton was associated with the IRR, so yay, branding, describes this part of Natal so beautifully. And then he takes, like the story itself, he goes from Natal to Johannesburg and he takes a geographic journey. And then he contrasts the closer you get to the city, there you cannot see the water running down. You know, there are no young men there. They've gone to the city. He contrasts this beauty and this, these two areas where things grow and are beautiful and where things die and are not. And that book really made me aware of the social fabric consequences of apartheid. I read it as a young you know, kid in high school, and that was the first time that I really understood, well, not really understood, that the understanding started to dawn on me that the cost of ideology is on a very human level. So, and I fully agree with Terence. I absolutely agree with Terence that this is perhaps, this social fabric corruption and erosion is probably the most visible remnant of apartheid. And it's very easy to put the blame there, and it will be true to put the blame there. But I must say it is tragic that this toxicity created by the NP has been maintained and sustained, and in many cases, perhaps even exacerbated in the two or three decades since. Because if we're going to be honest about this, I think Terence is right. There isn't much the government can do to fix this, but I think there's a whole bunch of things the government can stop doing to fix this. Number one is to make it easier for people to start businesses in their communities. I mean, that sounds like such a silly thing. But if you have to go to the city for every day, 30 minutes in, 30 minutes back, you're away from your kids for an hour every day. If you can cut that down to 10 or 5 or 15 minutes, it is a difference. If you tot those up over the 10 or 13 or 15, 17, 18 years, a child is under the authority and influence of their parents. That is something that was highlighted in Gang Town, spectacular book about the gang culture in the Cape, is these dislocations and dispossessions and, you know, forced movals. It really has consequences on a social fabric level. So make it easy for parents not to have to be so far away from their children to work. Make it easy. Stop putting things in the way of people being able to practice their skills in their communities where they can solve problems and earn an income. Make it easier for kids to go to the schools their parents choose, where they trust the moral fiber, the moral circumstances, the moral environment where they want their kids to grow up. I mean, we could go on, but there's so much the state could stop doing that won't solve this overnight, but would at least stop the rot and I think plant the seeds of the recovery, because this isn't a government solution issue, but this is possibly a generational government failure problem. So if there's anything that should be done, it is that the state should perhaps step back and empower people who really know what is best for their lives and their communities. And in that regard, the state could stop doing things rather than start doing new things.
Indeed. Right, let's move on to our last story for today. And this is an editorial written by Busi Mavuso, who is the CEO of Business Leadership South Africa. And basically, just to sort of very briefly, very simply summarize what he's saying in this editorial, or in this article rather, he says that South Africans need to join the dots between CADA deployment and state capture, and that CADA deployment has fed into state capture. Now, I'm very glad to see this argument being made, because a lot of people have actually been making this argument for a very long time. I'm glad to see that perhaps more mainstream South Africa is catching on to it. Terence, your thoughts?
Yeah, well, I'm quite an admirer of Busi Mavuso. I think that she's done really, really good work in being willing to speak up with a business community that often isn't. CADA deployment. I'm old enough to remember when it came onto the scene, and this is very chilling. It was 1997, 1998. The idea that the ANC would be putting its cadres in positions to control, quote, all levers of power. And there was an air of unreality in a lot of the commentary. I remember one guy writing something in the Sunday Independent to the effect of, now, you know, all we're doing is we're moving from from the sort of British model of permanent, senior civil servants, the American one where every administration appoints its own. It's a complete misreading of what was going on. The ANC did not have the skills to manage itself as a party. Then, started to use the state as a means of patronage, and the consequences are all around us. By 2009, there was a report into the state of local government, which rather delicately said something to the effect of "there's a big issue with the political administrative interface." That was City Press, to its great credit, called that out. Said this is CADA deployment. So this is kind of even been recognised by the government. Unfortunately, I think that the rigidity of ideology and of just the inability to sort of think beyond an existent worldview has leaves us in a situation where you have President Ramaphosa or Dr. Dlamini Zuma saying things like, "Oh well, you know, we see there's a problem. We're going to do it better now." You can't do this thing better. It is counter-constitutional. It has wreaked probably more havoc than anything else that the ANC has done. You either have a professional, meritocratic, career-oriented civil service, or you have the mess we have here. You don't get to sort of chop and change it. There's no halfway. We'll politicize it, make sure we have the right operatives, because the incentives that are created by that system lead to dysfunction.
Herman, in 40 seconds or so, your thoughts?
Yeah, no, I don't really have much to add to what Terence said. I was on a panel discussion on radio once where the the president of some black chamber of commerce or something said, no, cater deployment can be a massive success. It just needs to be done right. And I mean, it's fascinating insight. But I must say, I quickly glanced at the comments here on, and I just want to say that to the people who feel frustrated that we're not coming up with a solution here, I think, fair enough, that wasn't our aim with the previous discussion. I think one thing, however, we can do is learn from history. And one of the most valuable lessons about the capacity of the individual to improve their lives, we see in the descendants and immediate freed, the freed slaves and immediate descendants of those freed slaves between 1860 and 1960. 1860, when slavery was abolished in America, 1960, when the welfare state was really ramped up. For 100 years, you see generational progress, every generation being better schooled, better educated, healthier, wealthier, better living standards, longer lives of people in the South actively targeted by government not to have things. So these people weren't equipped by government to do anything. In fact, many of what of the things they did was illegal. It was illegal to send some black children to school in the American South, and the parents, not being schooled themselves, being former slaves, African slaves, would pay and bribe Baptist and Methodist pastors and people to teach their kids numeracy and literacy with no state involvement. So when we're not coming forward with a catch-all solution here, that's not our aim. Our aim is to say that either you trust in the idea of the individual being a sensible vehicle for problem solving on a societal level, and you get government to step back and let people be the solutions, or you don't. You have to be honest. Either you trust the individual to say, with all your mistakes, you can still do something better than a centralized government. And I think that's at the heart of classical liberalism. So apologies for not giving one policy solution here, but I think trying to do that would be counterproductive and would fall into the same pitfall of every well-meaning central planner.
All right, then that is all the time we have for today. So thank you very much, gentlemen, for joining me, and thank you to our listeners and watchers for joining us. Please support dailyfriend.co.za. Go check us out, read our stuff. I'm sure you'll be entertained or enlightened, or probably some combination of both. Anyway, thank you very much, and have a wonderful day. Cheers, everyone.